Support for WPR comes from Easter Seals Wisconsin with their annual fundraiser Wonderfully Human with dueling pianos, March 13th in Madison. Details on supporting people with disabilities at EasterSealsWisconsin.com.
Great to have you with us here for WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Time to talk taxes with Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. She and her husband David have been in the tax business for more than 30 years. They serve individuals, they consult other tax professionals, and they teach tax seminars around the country. Mary's been with us many times and always does a wonderful job. What questions do you have about filing your taxes? Maybe you retired this year, or maybe you made some energy-efficient updates to your home and you're wondering what you need to do in terms of taxes relating to that. Join the conversation. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Mary Mellum, welcome back. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
You're welcome. It's nice to be inside on this cold day.
It is indeed. I know you wanted to talk about Social Security, and let's start with that. What are people most confused about when it comes to Social Security and taxes?
Well, there are two confusing things that happen. The idea of taxation, what appears on the tax return, and those who retire early and confuse how much I can make and still collect my Social Security without giving it back. They're two completely different topics, and yet they get terribly confused.
Yeah, well, let's take them one at a time. What about the first one?
Okay. The idea of taxation of Social Security. If you receive Social Security and if you receive nothing but Social Security and you live on nothing but Social Security, and I mean no interest, no dividends, no retirement distributions, you're probably not going to pay taxes on any of the Social Security. Social Security has a formula, and IRS has a publication and has worksheets in it to calculate the taxable, what goes on the tax return, Social Security. And the bottom line is, in a quick words of saying it, there is a floor, and there are two levels of taxation. It could be up to 50% taxable or up to 85% taxable. And basically it says take all of your income, take plus half of your Social Security, add it together, and compare it to the floor. The floor for the 50% level is $32,000 for a married couple and $25,000 for a single person. If your income is, when you subtract that floor, you compare it to 50% of your income. If it's less, then you report the lesser for the 50% level. If you go higher, the higher range is for a married person, it's $44,000. Again, in that formula, your income plus half your Social Security. If it's over $44,000, then it can be up to 85% taxable. For the single person, if it's over $34,000, it can be 85% taxable. Now, that's the taxation side. It doesn't matter when you retired, whether you retired on disability, or what the situation is. If you are receiving Social Security payments, that's the taxation. End of discussion. Now, people are going to say, well, what's going on in the world? You know, the election just happened. I heard Social Security is not going to be taxable. Maybe that will happen. It hasn't happened yet. Who knows how fast things can and even if they ever get through. But at this point, if you are receiving Social Security and you get the nice, neat little form 1099 essay from the government, you have to compute the or consider the possibility of it being taxable.
What I'm a power of attorney for a family member, and the family member has not yet received his 1099 SA.
Then you need to go to the Social Security website with proper authorization and passwords and things. You can go to the website and print out that 1099 SA. There have been a lot of strange things happening, and in this world of technology, sometimes there's buttons that we press that say, send me an electronic copy and things. So you never know what's happening. Usually the 1099 essay comes out by the January 31st deadline. And I say usually. Some people get them earlier. Some people get them later. Some people never get them. If you are receiving Social Security payments, you should have one and need to look into it. This year, we've had a weird thing happen where married couples who you would think both would get the same treatment, but we have had a few where one spouse got it in the mail and the other didn't, and they have to go and download it or hope that it comes sometime. I understand that the Social Security Administration has kind of a trailing way of mailing them. In other words, they don't go to with all of them and send them to the post office on the very same day. And why some people get them and some people don't, I don't know. But if you didn't get it, go to the website, find out where it is, or at least call them and ask them to mail you another copy because you need it.
Our guest, Mary Mellum, tax professional from Ashwaubenon, and with her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Lots of questions coming in, Mary, so let's go to another Mary in Waupaca. Mary, hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I kind of have a timing and ramification issue. For 2023, I had a relative pass away, and so there was a lot of income from a lot of different sources. I'm also a member of two LLCs. So when it came time to file my taxes, I normally do them myself, and I was just simply overwhelmed. And I was an ostrich and put my head in the ground and didn't file any sort of return until December of 2024. I'm now working with an accountant to amend that return and fully report everything. But, and this is kind of odd, would I have been better off not filing at all?
Well, Mary, first of all, that's a tough question. If you had a return that was due, the sooner you file the return, the better. I think what I may be hearing in your voice is that you waited and maybe what you filed wasn't accurate.
Correct.
Okay.
But it is certainly admirable that you've taken the next step to seek out what you couldn't do yourself to help with. And my answer to that is, no, it isn't better that you didn't file. It's something that has to get fixed. Maybe it would have been easier for the person that you went to if you hadn't filed and gone to that person with everything. But hindsight is always 20/20. It's what you do in the future that is important. And having taken the steps to sort it all out is definitely the right thing.
Yeah. Mary, good luck with that. Thank you very much for calling. Bill in Wausau, we'll go to you. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, Larry, thanks for taking my call. We're retired, and our only income is Social Security and distribution from an IRA. And as I'm trying to do it myself this year on one of those two government free tax filing things, seems like we're eligible for only one of them because on the list of what's eligible, the 1099-R is not included. So I'm going to try to use the other one. But my question about the qualified charitable distribution is, I understand that's supposed to show up on the 1099-R from the mutual fund company, but where is that? How do I list that? Or is there a mistake on my thing from my fiduciary company?
Bill, that's a wonderful question. What Bill is talking about is QCDs. You're sending part of your retirement distribution to the charity. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, we usually wait till the end of the year and do it to charity so you can afford to give a little more, you know?
Okay. So your 1099-R is going to look exactly the way anybody else that did not do a QCD. There is no box that the government has put on it. What happens is that you or your preparer has to know that you did this. And the gross amount goes in the left side box, the gross box, and the QCD is subtracted from that before it goes into the taxable income column. And your software should produce three letters QCD to alert the government that that's why the difference between the left side and the right side of the gross box versus the taxable box. But it's not on the returns that you get. It's up to you to know how much you told your broker to send to the charities and to convey that information either to yourself or to your preparer. And then they will, through the software, do that calculation. I'm not sure that the direct file is set up to do anything like that. I know that the direct file exists and what it can do, but I don't know how sophisticated it is.
Yeah.
The means of subtracting those two numbers. Also in that light, if you do QCDs, you have given the money to a charity, and you need to have that thank you letter from the charity. Even though you didn't write the check, you didn't touch the money, you need to have that acknowledgement that the charity received it. It's no different than if you're putting it on a Schedule A as a charitable deduction. The same backup requirements exist.
There you go, Bill. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mary Mellum, our guest as we talk taxes. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at your taxes today with Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Questions, you can give a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's take a call from Martina in Shawano. Hi, Martina.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. This is probably a really simple question. So, say I lost my spouse last year, and I'm getting ready to file my taxes. What is my status?
Martina, first of all, my sympathy. Did your husband die in 2024 or 2023?
For the purposes of the example, let's say 24, but it was a while ago.
Okay. If your spouse died in 2024 and we are filing the 2024 tax return, your filing status is still considered married because the tax year... The year the spouse dies, you're considered to be married for that year. You can choose to file married jointly. That's usually what happens, or married separately, but you're considered to be married. I know that filing status is dependent is on the last day of the year, and technically if your spouse died during the year, you're no longer married. But it's a quirk in the system that allows, in the year of death, the marriage, allows it to be married filing joint easily. Again, there's little quirks. If your spouse died and you remarried before the end of the year, then you are married to that other person, and the spouse that died has to file a married separate return. Certainly, the spouse that died is considered married, whether it's married joint or married separate. But generally, you're married. You're not single. You're not head of household. You're married in that year.
Okay. Martha, there you go. Or Martina, thank you very much for calling. Rebecca in Waupaca, it's your turn. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, thank you for having me. I was calling in because I'm newly divorced as of March of last year. I filed last year with my ex-spouse, and now this year I'm to file alone or by myself, and so I'm wondering, is there anything to know about that?
That also is an excellent question. Again, as we talk about filing status, it's determined on the last day of the year. And for a divorced person, on the last day of the year, if you have not remarried in the year of divorce, you are considered single. Single status gives you either single or head of household if you have children that live with you and qualify you to be head of household. But in the year of divorce, you would either be single or head of household if you have children. The other thing to remember or to consider is the income. Wisconsin is a community property state or a marital property state. And as such, while you're married, your income, unless you've provided a signed a marital property settlement, half of the income belongs to each one of you. Now, you were divorced early in the part of the year, and I suspect that you may not have lived together at all during 2024. If that's the case, for federal purposes, you don't have to split the income that occurred that three-month period. Wisconsin doesn't quite say that. But if you don't know what that person's income is, they haven't identified it or sent it to you, probably you won't be splitting income. If there is someone that gets divorced in December, you're married for a long period of time, splitting income is probably something that's going to happen. In your case, you're probably going to take all of your own income, put it on a tax return, mark single or head of household, and file a tax return in that way.
Yeah, makes sense. Rebecca, good luck and thank you for calling. Larry in Madison, your turn. Hi, Larry.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I invested into a company that promised to pay me back 20% interest every year for 5 years. After 2 years of making payments, they did not make payments and they declared bankruptcy. Can I write off the amount that they still owed me as a loss for that year?
Basically, the answer is no. What you can write off is any of your unrecovered basis in the investment. If they paid you back 20% for 2 years or 3 years, I don't remember exactly what you said, did you get back all of the money that you gave them? To the extent that you didn't recover what you gave them initially, not the earnings they promised you, but what they gave you, you would have a loss to the extent of your unrecovered basis. You cannot take a loss for potential earnings that you did not get.
That makes sense as well. Larry, there you go. Thank you for calling. Jeff in Minocqua, on to you now. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
This is about doing a Roth conversion in December and having no other taxable income for the earlier part of the year, and an estimated payment was made by January 15th of the following year. But when doing taxes, the software program keeps indicating a penalty is due because estimated taxes were not paid throughout the full year. Is there a way to not pay the penalty because there was no taxable event at any other time earlier in the year? And maybe is it better to not pay estimated taxes during the year because that then triggers the idea of owing a penalty?
Wow. Okay. You did a Roth conversion at the end of the year. The Roth conversion gives taxable income. And so for the whole year, whatever the amount you converted is considered your income for the whole year. IRS expects people to make payments evenly throughout the year. If you made a payment to cover that Roth conversion at the end of the year, the only way to get out of that penalty is to file an annualized exception. You would have to go to the 2210 form, which calculates the penalty. I believe it's page 2. It is a nasty form to fill out, but that's the only way to tell them that the income happened in the last quarter of the year, and that's all my penalty should be based on.
There you go, Jeff. Thank you very much for calling. Tiani in Wisconsin Rapids, your turn. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Thank you. I'm calling. I have a small business with a friend of mine. We own it 50-50 partnership. We've been told that we cannot claim gas mileage on our business because of it being a partnership. But we do over 100 miles a week in driving. Is there a different way to set up our business so that we can claim that?
Okay. Here's the deal with your partnership. Who do the vehicles belong to that you drive?
Mainly, it is my business partner's vehicle.
Okay. So your business partner's vehicle is driven. It is not the partnership's vehicle. The vehicle is not owned by the...
It's her personal, correct, yeah.
Okay. So the best way to do that, because the partnership doesn't own the vehicle, the partnership has no vehicle expenses. In the partnership agreement, you can set up how you want to handle it. And the way you could all set it up is either you can set up it so that the partners report their mileage to the partnership and the partnership reimburses their mileage. Otherwise, the partnership agreement can say that I, the partner, am responsible for providing the vehicle and mileage for it. And with that, the partner would calculate their own expense and take it on a Schedule E, page 2, as a partner-paid expense. Okay. Unreimbursed partnership expense. But the partnership agreement should address what you're planning to do with it.
All right. Tiani, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Jake in Park Falls, your turn. Hi, Jake.
Hi. Me and my fiance have been together for about 5 years now. We live together. We have 2 kids, and I am the only income. I was wondering if I'm able to claim her as a dependent. Sorry if that question's been asked already.
It hasn't been asked. That's an interesting question. If she meets the dependency tests for you, the answer is yes. I'm not aware of anything. There is a rule in the dependencies that if the relationship violates local law, you couldn't. I don't think cohabitation is against the law in Wisconsin. It may be in some other state. But the dependency exemption, she's certainly not a qualifying child of yours. but she could be a qualifying relative. And that means that she meets all the dependency tests, most of which is that you provide more than half of the support. She lives in, well, she doesn't, she is either a member of your household or a member of your family, which she would have to be a member of your household. And she does not have gross income of more than $5,050. Now, that being said, what you're going to benefit from that is $500 on the federal and $25 on the state.
All right. Jake, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. Some emails that we should go through. Linda in Appleton wonders, is the website ID.me legitimate? Linda tried to make an account with the IRS and was sent there.
ID.me is one of the programs that the IRS and other government agencies use to verify income. If you don't set up an account through ID.me and get a password, there are many things like direct file that you will not be able to do. So, yes, ID.me is legitimate. Of course, use common sense. If you go to a website and it looks like it used that and some other letters with it or something, that may not be legitimate. But ID.me is a legitimate program.
All right. Lorraine emailed us, purchased cellular shades for a number of windows last year. The receipts show that they qualify for the federal energy tax credit. Should she claim this credit on line 18 of form 5695?
Okay. Assuming that her paperwork is legitimate, that it qualifies. Line 18 is insulation and air sealing materials. I guess that looks as good a place or as any of those do. I would guess that that would be a reasonable thing. I would check, first of all, go to the instructions to the 5695, look at the instructions to line 18 as well as the window line, and see if there is anything in there that specifically tells you the shades.
All right. There you go. Pam emailed, last year was the first year Pam had to take a required minimum distribution. Pam opted to donate the charities via a qualified charitable deduction. All transactions were completed between Pam's financial advisor's office and the charities. However, Pam is now receiving tax statements from these charities, and the contributions are showing up along with other donations she's made. Pam understands that you are supposed to receive a separate letter from the charities for these QCDs. Would you be able to use these tax receipts for QCDs?
Good question. We did talk about QCDs a little bit earlier. It's a good showing of what you need. There is nothing in the law that I know of that says a QCD receipt has to be separate from other receipts. You have to have acknowledgement that they received your money. And if you made other charitable contributions, list the whole charitable contribution, subtract out the QCD part, and the rest of it is what goes on Schedule A. But you need to have an acknowledgement. However it is, some of them will acknowledge that it is a QCD. Others will just tell you have donated X amount and you need to match up the numbers that came from the RMD versus the stuff that you wrote checks or credit cards for.
Okay. And Dan emailed us, what if you made a large charitable donation in 2024? So you made it all in 2024. Do you have some options to spread the donation amount over multiple years, or do you need to use it all in 2024?
If you made the contribution directly to the charity in 2024, it's to be used in 2024. You don't have the ability to spread. Now, that being said, there are organizations that you can, well, even those organizations, the spreading of it, some people will make a large charitable contribution to an organization that kind of holds on to the money, and you get to take the deduction in that year, but you can give it out in other years, not the deduction-wise, but you can say, okay, I'm going to give $5,000 of this $100,000 I put into, and I forget the term. It's kind of, it's a charity that holds on to the money, and you tell them when and where to give it. But your deduction is the year you give it to that charitable holding organization.
Got it. Deb in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Deb.
Hi. I have a direct primary care provider, and I pay a monthly stipend every month, and I'm wondering if I can pay her through my HSA.
Okay, let me understand what you're asking. A direct primary care provider, do you mean that someone comes into your home and takes care of you? Is it like a nursing person? Or exactly
no,
what?
She's independent, has her own office. She is unaffiliated with any healthcare organization. So she's a direct primary care provider. And I was originally told that I could make the payments out of my HSA, but I heard something yesterday that said I could not. So I'm just trying to get clarification.
Well, I don't think the question is whether it can come out of an HSA or not. Is it a qualified medical expense? If it's a qualified medical expense, it can be paid out of an HSA. With the exception of insurance, insurance has special requirements regarding insurance being paid with HSA money. But if it is a qualified medical expense, whether you do it out of an HSA or out of your pocket, it's still a medical expense. So my concern is, if she is a qualified medical person that is providing this service, then there's no question it should be able to be paid out of a medical, out of an HSA.
All right, Deb, there you go. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it. John had a question, who took cashed out a whole life policy of $100,000, but was told that he had paid over the course of time $32,000 toward that, wondering if he can take that amount away from the $100,000 in order for his taxes to be filled.
If you cash in a whole life insurance policy, your cash value minus all the premiums that you've paid over time is the taxable portion. So if he received $100,000 when he cashed in the life insurance policy, the taxable event would be $100,000 minus the $32,000.
Got it. James in Bellevue has a question. Hi, James.
Hi, Larry. Good to hear from you. Hey, my question is concerning the amount or the percentage of your gross, adjusted gross income that you can contribute to nonprofits. In 24, I kind of went wild and did a lot of contributing to a lot of different activities. And I would like to be able to, of course, to deduct it. So I'm just wondering, is there a percentage limitation or anything like that?
There's, first of all, your charitable deductions, and I'm assuming these are all qualified charities for charitable 501c3, that type of organizations. If we're talking about other kinds that don't have to pay taxes, that are nonprofits, we're not talking about that, or what I'm going to say is not addressing that. But if you do give to qualified charities, your deduction goes on Schedule A, and you are limited in what you can write off on the Schedule A. But anything you can't write off in this year is allowable to be carried over for 5 years. But then beyond that, there are certain types of charities where you can't take it all at once. There are what we call 50% charities, which is the norm, that you give to someone and they're considered 50%. And I think probably 50% is what you're looking for. But there are some charities that are like that are 20% or 30%, so that you can only deduct up to 20% of your AGI when you're giving to those organizations. And some of those are charities that are not sponsored by the public, that have few donors, private foundations, that's the word I'm looking for, that if you're donating to those kind, the limitation might be 20% or 30%. Mm-hmm. But normally it's 50%, and then you carry any excess over to future years.
James, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Charles in Waupaca, your turn. Hi, Charles.
Hi, this is an estate question. The deceased had paperwork from the IRS threatening collection it's old paperwork, and we're not sure if the person paid off the IRS. Is there a way to determine that?
The person who is in charge of the estate of the decedent can file, number one, a Form 56, which identifies them as the person in charge, which allows the IRS to talk to them. That means that you have to have the letter of appointment, or if there's a trust, prove that you're the trustee. Once the IRS can recognize that person, you can ask for a transcript, and you can get a transcript of an account transcript that basically shows any amount that's still owed by that person, or you can get a wage and income transcript that would show you for a particular year what kind of documents the IRS has received for that person. Keep in mind that if you are the representative of a decedent, that representative is required to file all returns that haven't been filed previously that require filing. So getting that transcript or transcript of an account transcript is something that anybody who is representing a decedent should do if they can't find that they have filed the appropriate taxes.
Mm. Charles, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mary Mellum, our guest today, tax professional with Schwabenen Tax Professionals from Green Bay, our guest today as we talk taxes. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on WPR News, Larry Mueller, as we talk taxes with Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Aaron in Spring Green has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Aaron.
Hey there, Larry and Mary. Thanks for taking my call. And Mary, wow, so impressive, your knowledge. And I always learn a lot when you're on. I have a question about gift tax. Form 709, I guess. H&R Block wants to charge $380 to file that form. And I'm just curious if there's any reason why I don't just print it out, fill it out, and send it in myself versus rely on a tax professional for that form for a one-time cash gift?
It's hard to say that. Everybody charges differently. So that is, yes, you can file the form like anything else. It's a question of knowing the rules. Why you hire a professional is because, you know, they're more experienced in the rules. If you want to take the time to do the research, it's not impossible. They have changed the form this year. It used to be a 4-page form, and I believe it's gone to an 8-page form. Just a different layout than it is. Plus, it's now electronically, it is able to be electronically filed. But first of all, you know, how do you know you're required to file it? I guess that's starting with the gift tax form. The 709 has specific requirements. A lot of times people don't have to file it if their gifts are small enough. And, you know, learning that, you can certainly do it yourself. It can be mailed in. But that's why you pay a professional, because they know the rules that you don't want to take the time to learn.
Yeah.
I hope that helps.
That help, Aaron?
Yes, the $27,000, I'm assuming, is what you meant by the whether or not you need to file. But
no,
I did not know that you can. Go ahead.
$18,000 of a gift of a present interest is the filing requirement. I don't know where the $27,000 is coming from. But $18,000 is the number for 2024. $19,000 is the number for 2025.
All right. Aaron?
Now, if you are giving something of future value or setting up a trust, there is no minimum number. Anything you put into a trust or anything you do as a gift of a future interest is reportable from dollar one.
Okay. Aaron, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Glenn in Middleton will give you a chance. Hi, Glenn.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I am so fortunate to be married to a woman who received a large capital gain payout, or I guess the both of us, because it's her investment in a mutual fund, but it's a joint account. And in mid-December, we got the notification of how much this rather large capital gain payout was going to be. That's the first we knew. And I immediately made an advance payment of federal tax in an appropriate percentage, and also state of Wisconsin tax in appropriate percentage. My concern is that there would be a penalty because, well, we weren't paying this all through the year because we didn't know this was going to happen till the end of the year. So when do we incur that? I guess we incur the liability when we receive the funds, but is that sufficient to just wait till the end of the year when you actually know you're getting a capital gain payout from a mutual fund and then pay the anticipated taxes on that?
Once again, Glenn, this is a really good question. As I mentioned earlier, the IRS at the end of the year assumes that you should be paying the income evenly throughout the year. That being said, there is a fail-safe that says we won't charge you a penalty if you pay by the due date of the return as long as your balance due is not more than $100,000. I mean, if you don't pay it evenly during the year, even if you owe, that could be a problem. But here's the fail-safe. The fail-safe says that if you have paid in 100% of last year's taxes or 90% of the current year's taxes, you would not have a penalty to worry about. So what you paid in your normal payments did you pay that in the same as last year? And then you just made these extra payments over and above. Again, if you've paid in more than 100% of last year's taxes, you shouldn't have a penalty. And again, the timing of it sometimes triggers a little penalty, but you can always get out of that or reduce it by doing the annualized exception. But in a year where you have a larger payout that wasn't expected, as long as you have covered last year's taxes, then, and what I mean by that is 23. If you look at your 23 tax return and look at the amount of tax you owe, not the tax, you know, not the refund or balance due, but look at the line that says total tax. If you have paid in that much this year to cover last year's taxes, the worst that could happen is that you get a little payment for being untimely, you know, not evenly across the year. But again, the 100% of last year's taxes or the 90% of the current year is the way to avoid those large penalties.
There you go, Glenn. Thank you so much for calling. Richard emailed, how much can you earn with no tax? And Richard is single and 75 years old.
Okay. That's a good question to know. I mean, that's good to know what his status is. For the federal purposes, if you have earned income that is not self-employment income, which creates self-employment tax, you can earn, if you're 65 years of older or single, $16,550 without paying any federal tax, or $14,180 without paying any state tax. It's the standard deduction that you can earn up to the standard deduction as long as it's not self-employment income, which creates self-employment tax, different from income tax. You can have that much earnings and not have to then file a tax return.
For penalty and tax purposes, what's the difference between withdrawing early from a traditional and Roth account?
If you are under the age of 59 and a half or do not have another one of the exceptions to the penalty, if you withdraw from an IRA or a pension early, there is a 10% penalty that exists on top of the income tax that you have. For a Roth IRA, if you do not remove any more than the money that you invested, your basis in the Roth, if you will, there is no penalty for that. If you remove the earnings, then you will have the penalty as well.
Mary Mellum, our guest today, as we talk taxes with her, oh, it's great to have Mary come by and visit with us. You can join in, too, if you have a question or comment. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Just a reminder, we're going to be talking about some of the financial support you can receive and find after a cancer diagnosis. That's at 12:30 today. And tomorrow we'll be talking about state parks in northern Wisconsin, and we'll hear about the Snowshoe National Championships taking place in Brilliant. But for now, it's taxes. Join in with your questions and comments. Looking forward to hearing from you. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking taxes today on the show with Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon and Tax Professionals. Great to have her back, and we have lots of callers online, Mary, and we have a bunch of emails too, so let's go right to it. John in Madison, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Mary. I neglected to file my form 8606, which is a non-deductible IRA, for 4 years in a row. Is the proper way to file these is it just to send an 8606 with my, I understand it's a $50 penalty, in separate envelopes? Is that still, am I still
what
able to do that?
What I would do for you, John, is do the 8606 for the proper year for each one of them. Because it's a standalone form, you can sign it and send it by itself. But I would send all four of them, or whatever the number, in one envelope. I'd probably take a bright piece of paper and put a note on the front of it that this includes previously unfiled 8606s. I assume the IRS has not contacted you because you used it and they said we have no record of it. Is that the case?
Well, I haven't tapped into my IRA yet. So
if you do it proactively, you probably will not see a penalty. But I would do them all, put it in one envelope, and not do it piecemeal because they may not get to the right place if you do it piecemeal.
Yeah, makes sense. John, there you go. Thank you for calling. Bruce in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Bruce.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, yeah, I sold some property last year, Honeyland, and we owned it for 35 years in a partnership. And there's going to be some capital gains. I just don't know what I can deduct as expenses over that period of time.
First of all, if you owned it in a partnership, did you have a formal partnership that you filed 1065s for, or were you just multiple names on the deed?
Yeah, we're multiple names on the deed.
Okay, so the partnership is not a formal partnership.
Okay.
And, well, that being said, it makes a difference. All of you, when the property was sold, all of you had to sign the contract. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So if there were any selling expenses, you would be able to deduct the selling expenses. Like you went through a broker, you had to do some recording fees, things like that. Also, you need to know what your cost in that property was. And what did you originally pay for it? Did the property Hunting Lamb have any improvements on it, like a trailer, a cabin, anything like that? All of that would go into it.
All right. Bruce, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. And Tom in Jackson, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hello. I retired early this summer, and I was given an incentive to leave. And so now I'm collecting a pension, and also I took my Social Security just at the end of being 63 years old. So I was wondering what can I expect now as far as my tax bill and stuff.
Well, that's a very broad question. If you retired in the middle of the year, I would assume that you had a W-2.
Yes.
That you're still received from the company you worked for.
Yes.
Yeah.
Did that, when you said you had an incentive to leave, did they promise to pay you salary, or did they give you a severance package or something like that?
It was a certain dollar amount for the amount of years that I had worked.
Okay, and that would come through on your W-2. And that you'd be reporting. if you collected Social Security, probably 85% of whatever you collected during the year is added to your income, plus whatever the pension that you've taken out, that you've actually taken out in this year. If you took your pension and rolled it over, the rollover is not taxable. It's only the part that you kept. So in this transition year, you're looking at probably the things that you had before, plus the Social Security, plus the pension that you kept.
All right. Tom, there you go. Thank you for calling. Here's another Tom in Madison. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Larry. Thank you. We had a caller who asked who just cashed in some or all of his mutual fund. And I understood him to ask whether he should have been paying taxes over the last year or two based on the supposed increase of his mutual fund value. And the answer is, if I understood it correctly, no, he didn't have to pay anything until he cashed out, because that mutual fund could have fluctuated up or down anytime.
Yeah.
So what do you think, Mary?
I guess I'm wondering what your question is. Are you asking what's the tax consequences of cashing in the mutual fund?
No, I thought that he asked if he should have been paying taxes because his mutual fund value increased, and the answer would be no, not until he cashed in some or any portion.
I agree. If you have a mutual fund, you do not have a sale of that mutual fund, i.e. recognition of an increase in value, until you sell it. However, with mutual funds, oftentimes they pay dividends through the years, and what is taxable is the dividends that the mutual funds, or the capital gains that the mutual funds, are paying out. And those would be taxable while you're holding the mutual fund, even if you don't receive them. And a lot of times they're reinvested, which gives you additional cost basis in your mutual funds. If you're doing this all through a broker, the brokers usually do a pretty good job of keeping track of all of that basis in it.
All right. Tom, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Cheryl in Berlin, your turn. Hi, Cheryl.
Yeah, I have a question. Last year, I paid out $38,000 for my husband's medical care, and the only deduction I have is property taxes. Would I be able to get any of that money reimbursed?
Let me ask. There is more to the story. I think what you're saying is, if I had medical expenses of $38,000, could that cause me to itemize together with my property taxes? And the answer is probably yes. Remember, medical expenses are a deduction, an itemized deduction, and the medical expenses have to exceed, the deductible medical expenses have to exceed 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. So part of how much is left to deduct depends on what your adjusted gross income is and other things on your tax return. If you're married filing jointly, the standard deduction goes between, is about $30,000. So to benefit from it on the federal return, your collective itemized deductions would have to be greater than your standard deduction. Depending on how large your income is, your adjusted gross income, 7.5% of that would go against that. If you had $100,000 of income, AGI, 7.5% would be $7,500. That away from $38,000 would still leave you $30,000 plus your property taxes. And there's charitable contributions to consider. In your $38,000, I don't know if you've included your insurance premiums that you might be paying, so that $38,000 might be a bigger number. So, yes, there is a possibility, but you've got to look at everything to know exactly what it is. And on the state tax return, because of the way the state itemized deduction credit works, you might be able to get a credit without even using the Schedule A on the federal return. So lots of variables in there, but there is certainly potential to it.
It sure sounds like it. Cheryl, thank you very much for calling. Mike in Fond du Lac, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Actually, I have more of a comment than a question, I guess. I had been using TurboTax for a number of years, and they would not allow me a deduction, I think, in Wisconsin for the long-term care insurance premium, as if it wasn't allowed. Well, I know it's allowed, and I went ahead and mailed in my Wisconsin and put the other one in through TurboTax. So after that happened, I decided, well, I'm looking for an alternative. And I looked at the free file options on the IRS site, and all of them had an income limit. I think it was $84,000. My son, my adult son, suggested I try Cash App, which is free but doesn't have an income limit. And I have used it the last 2 years, and it works very well. And it is free.
Yeah. There you go. Mike, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Dave in Lodi emailed us. Dave retired at age 62 and plans to take Social Security and Medicare in November at age 65. Dave currently has single marketplace health insurance that includes an HSA. Dave hopes to take a seasonal part-time job in 2025. Can Dave put 100% of that income into the HSA?
I'm assuming that Dave is talking about the current year that he is retiring.
Yeah.
Once you reach 65, you're no longer able to contribute to the HSA. So his contribution would be based on a prorated basis. The maximum that he could put into the HSA is prorated by the number of months before he is eligible for Medicare. I think that's what he's asking for the question.
Yeah, I think so too. Vicki in Millidor emailed us the letter from the charity that received a qualified charitable distribution donation. Their letter of thanks should say that the check came from your retirement plan, especially if you also made a direct contribution too. Vicki's financial advisor always sends a letter to Vicki saying that they sent the distribution directly to the charity and how much it was.
I think that's excellent advice, but there is... You, the taxpayer, are responsible for getting the information from the broker, which is wonderful that the broker follows up with it, and to have the receipt from the charity saying the charity received the money. The charity has no obligation to say exactly that it came from the QCD. Obviously, it's nicer if they tell you that or identify it. We have had some problems with the charities because some of the charities identify it as a non-deductible contribution, which is not right on the part of the charity. I would almost rather have the charity just say, thank you very much, we received this amount of money, and you subtract the amount that is accounted for elsewhere. because the idea of the charity saying that this non-deductible contribution could be confusing and may be interpreted differently by the IRS. So there are no requirements. It's just you've got to have some common sense and you've got to have proof the charity received.
Jane emailed us. Jane is the president of the local Quilt Guild in Sun Prairie. They've just set up a checking account with a new tax number. They charge dues to members and write checks to presenters, speakers, so forth, at their meetings. They're a nonprofit, and they make a lot of quilts for donations to charities. Jane wonders, does she need to file taxes on behalf of the Quilt Guild?
Potentially. What Jane, she says she's a nonprofit. If she has filed for nonprofit status from the IRS, then she is filing a 990 form. Small nonprofits that maybe are not required to file still have to file an information return. It's kind of a postcard that's called a 990N. And if you are small enough and not to have the need for extra, you know, money earnings from investments and things like that, it's probably the 990N that she would need to file. But again, if she's a qualified nonprofit, that she's applied for nonprofit status, that would be it. If you just are assuming you're nonprofit if not have filed the status, then it's like an association that would need to file an 1120 form, probably.
Susan in Kenosha emailed, as a grandparent, Susan would like to establish a 529 account for a grandson with a $90,000 contribution out of her traditional IRA. Why does it get considered as taxable income to Susan in one tax year, but is reported over 5 years as a gift to the grandchild? Should Susan just go with the $18 annual gift tax limit instead?
That's a good tax planning question on Susan's part. If Susan does the one-time funding of it, she essentially has received $90,000, i.e. taxable, and she is contributing it to a 501 or to a 529 plan. The 90 that she's looking at is 5 years worth of gift tax exclusion, and there is a special rule for gift tax purposes, not income tax purposes, but for gift tax purposes that allows you to put up to the annual exclusion one time, file it on one return, check the box, and avoid having to file every year or not file at all. But you've made a taxable gift because it's over the $19,000 for 2025, and you would normally need to file a gift tax return. This is saying, I don't have a taxable gift. It doesn't go against my estate if I check the box at one time. The easier way for her probably and less tax consequences might be just to take out the $19,000, put it in each year, and go from there. Again, it depends on what the overall tax situation she's in before knowing which is really the best answer.
Yeah. Fran emailed us. Fran received a 1099 NEC from a previous employer. Because Fran still teaches a virtual Zumba class for them, so she got... She's still teaching the class, but is not employed in any other way. Fran doesn't have her own business teaching Zumbas just for fun. Does Fran need to file a Schedule C since the employer sent a 1099 NEC?
The answer to that is that when the IRS receives a 1099 NEC, they see that person as being in a business. So IRS will expect to see a Schedule C in her tax return. If she is truly doing it as a hobby and not in it to make money, then it should be hobby income, thus avoiding self-employment tax. But to get past the IRS, she's got to do the Schedule C, put it in, take it out, and then report it as hobby income.
Okay. Cindy in Green Bay emailed, they were lucky enough to have been given a piece of property many years ago. Their question is, since it was a gift to them, if they don't sell it, would there be a bump up when they pass it on to their children?
The answer to that is, first of all, since it was a gift, the cost basis in that gift and Cindy's basis in the gift right now is whatever the person who gave it to her paid for it or their basis in it. That being said, when the owner of the property dies, the property is revalued at its fair market value. So if she intends to will it to someone, yes, they would get an increased value.
John in Fitchburg emailed, for what types of filers is the new IRS direct filing software suited?
Well, I would say more or less simple tax returns. So in answer to the question, there is no income limit. So you can make $1 million and use the direct file program if you have the kind of forms that are qualified there. And just as a quick reminder, W-2s, Social Security, interest, gambling, retirement, 1099-Rs, and if you live in Alaska, the Alaska dividend payment. That's the extent of the kind of income. You cannot have rental property. You cannot have a business. You cannot have capital gains or dividends and use that form. And then there are only certain can't itemize. You can have the teacher's deduction, student loan interest, HSAs, and you can claim the earned income credit, the child tax credit, the premium tax credit, the savers credit, and the Schedule R credit. And that's basically the limitations at this point to using the direct file. And in order to find out whether you can use it, you have to go into the IRS website through ID.me and answer questions to determine your eligibility.
Ah. Mary, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much, and definitely look forward to your next visit. Thank you, Mary.
You are very welcome.
Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals, our guest today. She does a wonderful job, doesn't she? Really appreciate her time. Coming up, we're going to talk about what to do when you face a cancer diagnosis, there, financial and otherwise. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to turn our attention to cancer, facing a cancer diagnosis. It's certainly one of the most challenging experiences anyone can go through. And of course, there's the immediate medical concerns, but there's also many emotional and financial details that can become overwhelming. And today we're going to be talking about some of the financial support you can find after a cancer diagnosis with a couple of guests. One of them, Isaac Scher, with us today. He's a participant in the American Cancer Society's Road to Recovery program. Isaac's an author and writer. He's also a brain cancer survivor. Isaac, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show, Larry. It's an honor.
Well, it's great to have you with us. Amy Kralichek is with us as well. She's Associate Director of the Access to Care Solutions Delivery Program of the American Cancer Society. And Amy, thank you for joining us as well.
Oh, you are so very welcome. I'm so happy to be here.
As we talk with our guests, I hope you'll join in. Tell us about the support and resources maybe you found when you got a cancer diagnosis. Who was a big help to you? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Amy, let's say you've just received a cancer diagnosis. For so many, this is a very overwhelming time. What's your advice on what to do first?
The absolute first thing that I would say is to contact the American Cancer Society. We have so many programs and services, so much resources and references that are all free of charge, and we can help you even if it's just somebody you need somebody to listen to you. Contact the American Cancer Society. We're here to help, and we may be able to assist you in ways that you haven't even thought about yet.
Yeah.
So contact the American Cancer Society.
So what are the most common barriers people face when they seek treatment for cancer, Amy?
You know, it really depends upon each individual situation, of course, but one of the top barriers that we hear about is transportation. Every year, around 3.6 million Americans miss at least one medical appointment due to lack of transportation. Often right after a diagnosis, there may be lots of friends and family around that can help, but maybe your spouse has to go back to work because to keep insurance, or, you know, maybe your family lives out of town and you're alone, or you're not able to drive because of a medical condition. And so the American Cancer Society does have a program called Road to Recovery that offers free rides for cancer patients to cancer treatment-related appointments. So we have volunteer drivers all across the United States that are willing and able to pick up the patients and take them back and forth to their cancer treatments.
It's a great service, and we'll certainly be talking about more of the ways the American Cancer Society can help out if you receive that diagnosis. How's the American Cancer Society funded?
The American Cancer Society is a nonprofit organization, and so our funding really is through individuals, donors, businesses who support the work of the American Cancer Society, and we appreciate everybody's support in order for us to be able to provide free services like Bridge Recovery.
Yeah. Isaac, I want to give you a chance to get involved here. Tell us a little about your story. When were you first diagnosed with cancer?
Well, I was diagnosed in the fall of 2018. I had a seizure just almost literally out of nowhere, complete surprise. And I was rushed to the hospital, and the CAT scan revealed a brain tumor. And after it was removed, they did a biopsy, and, well, that's it was diagnosed as malignant, glioblastoma multiforme.
Boy. Now that, yeah. Your life must have been changed so much after
completely
that.
Completely flipped upside down, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, tell us more of the story. You were working at the time.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, what happened there is, so for a while, the job that I had just started, you know, they were willing to accommodate me and then, you know, my needs for treatment for a while. But then last summer, unfortunately, they said they would no longer be able to accommodate my medical needs. So my employment there ended, and I'm now a full-time author. I have a science fiction fantasy romance novel out called A Cloak of Blades. And I have another contemporary romance novel coming out in May called Unconventional, about people meeting and falling in love at an anime convention. And so trying to support myself through my writing, although I'm also, because of my cancer and some related factors because of that, I am no longer able to hold down a full-time normal job. So I am receiving Social Security disability. And also because it's no longer safe for me to drive because of various cancer-related problems, I am a recipient of the Road to Recovery program. And that's been a huge assistance for me financially because I don't always have friends and family available to drive me, and I can't drive myself anymore. Uber and Lyft rides, those add up very quickly. You know, I can still use those if no volunteers are available on a given day, which does sometimes happen. But not having to rely on private services like that for, you know, two or three times a week is a huge financial help. You know, so this Road to Recovery program is a real lifesaver for me.
Yeah. How did you find the help or the resources to get through some of the issues? That, I mean, this is a very difficult thing.
Well, I was told about the Road to Recovery program by my oncologist once it was determined that, yeah, I really shouldn't be behind the wheel of a car anymore. He recommended I reach out to the ACS, and they were immediately on the ball. I was like, yeah, we can help with that. Here's how this works, and hooked me right up.
That's amazing. Well, Amy, let's talk a bit more about this Road to Recovery program. Who's qualified to take part in that Road to Recovery program?
Yeah, anyone who has been diagnosed with cancer, you do have to have a cancer diagnosis in order to be eligible for the Road to Recovery program. The patients do have to be ambulatory, meaning they need to be able to get to the vehicle and get in and out of the vehicle on their own. And the reason that stipulation is in place is because our drivers are volunteer drivers, and they provide curb-to-curb service, and they're not trained to lift patients in and out of vehicles. We definitely want to keep everyone as safe as possible. Now, the patients are able to bring a caregiver with them if needed, so if they do need a little bit of extra assistance that the caregiver can provide, then by all means. But if someone is determined that they're not eligible, the American Cancer Society also maintains a database of other programs that are available. So if someone perhaps is in a wheelchair and or on in a hospital bed where they can't literally get in and out of a vehicle on their own, there are other services from other organizations that we can definitely help connect that patient to. But really, if someone is a cancer patient and they need assistance with transportation, I would encourage them to contact the American Cancer Society at cancer.org, or they can always call us 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year at 1-800-227-2345. There is a stipulation also that they cannot be under anesthesia, just because, again, our drivers are not medical professionals, and they would need, if they're going to have surgery, they need to find a different way to get home.
Yeah, for sure. I'm thinking about the other side of this, and that would be the volunteer side, the driver side. What if you wanted to volunteer for the program? How do people do that, and what do they need to have as qualifications?
Yeah. Again, they can go to cancer.org and check everything out, but they do need to be between the ages of 18 and 84. They do have to have a vehicle in good working condition, or access to a vehicle in good working condition, adequate car insurance, and it really, all of the volunteers I work with, they are just absolutely some of the most amazing people on the planet. But they always say, I get so much more out of volunteering than what the patients do when they're literally driving someone to help save their life with cancer treatment. But there's so much that they get in return.
Yeah. Isaac, what's it?
Very kind and beautiful souls through this program. The volunteer drivers are extremely compassionate.
I was just going to ask you that. So it sounds like you've had very good experiences with that program.
Nothing but positive experiences.
Amy, another resource you offer is an app called ACS Cares. What kinds of information do people find on that app?
Yeah, as you mentioned earlier on, when you're diagnosed with cancer, it is so overwhelming. And many times what they tell you in the doctor's office is just, it's too much. And so we have a new app called ACS Cares that can be downloaded for free. And it really goes through the patient navigation side of things, helping with the patient's needs and really digging down into what specific needs they have and what resources are available to them. It could be anything from, I need a hospital bed. Where do I find a hospital bed? Help with the transportation, like we talked about. Help with they're going through their cancer. They're having some side effects. Is this normal? It's just absolutely amazing help for anyone who's been diagnosed with cancer, or even a caregiver or a loved one can download the app too to help your cancer patient through their cancer journey.
Yeah. Amy Kralichek, Associate Director of the Access to Care Solutions Delivery Program of the American Cancer Society, and our other guest, Isaac Scher, is a participant in the American Cancer Society Road to Recovery Program. Great to have them with us. Questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk about cancer with a couple of guests, Isaac Scher, a participant in the American Cancer Society's Road to Recovery program. He's also an author and writer. And Amy Kralichek is the Associate Director of the Access to Care Solutions Delivery Program of the American Cancer Society. Questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Does the Road to Recovery Program have rural drivers?
We do in some areas. We are mostly in the larger metro areas, but we do have some Road to Recovery drivers in the rural areas that are willing to drive into the metro areas. It really just depends where you are. The American Cancer Society also has other transportation resources that are available, whether that's through some partner organizations that we have through grants that the American Cancer Society gives out to assist those more rural patients getting to their cancer care in the larger metropolitan areas. Again, the best thing to do if you need transportation assistance is contact the American Cancer Society at cancer.org or call 1-800-227-2345.
Another email. How common is it to hear that cancer patients have lost their job? If you're diagnosed with cancer, how can you find or keep employment?
That's a great question. I don't know the exact answer to that. There's a lot of potential legalities around, you know, if someone was let go when they shouldn't have been let go with the human resource protections that we have in place for cancer patients. It's having cancer scary, and then you add everything else on top of it. It's a lot. And again, contact the American Cancer Society, even though we may not have that exact answer. We definitely have partners that work in the legal side of things that can assist.
Yeah. Isaac, turn to you again, but what are some of the best ways for you, for people to support people living with brain cancer?
Ooh, well, emotional support, I think, is probably the most important. And I know in my particular case, my family rallied around me and made me feel like I was not alone, and that was really critical. Let's see here. I'm just trying to think of maybe a better way to answer that, more concrete answer for you. I would say, like, for me personally, I asked my family not to second guess my choices with regards to how I was going to pursue treatment. Like, I had family members who wanted to offer all sorts of homeopathic remedies and other, you know, alternative medicines, which I found really unpleasant and intrusive. And I set down a boundary, like, look, this is my decision. This is my life. I'm consulting with my doctor. I'm going to go with what they suggest, and I don't want you to second guess that. This is difficult for me enough without other people second guessing me. And that was an important boundary for me to set.
Yeah, well, that makes good sense. What about, paying for medical bills? I know the American Cancer Society doesn't provide direct financial support.
No.
If someone needs help with that, where do they go?
Well, in my case, my family set up a GoFundMe where we're friends and family and even complete strangers were able to donate to a fund that my brother manages, where if I get a medical bill, I send that on to my brother and he's able to pay that bill on my behalf using the money that we've collected through this GoFundMe. But there's only so much you can do with that. And sometimes these bills get pretty overwhelming. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah. Someone else here is wondering in an email, did you make use of, Isaac, any social support groups?
Not directly. I had the social support from friends and family in that regard, but I was actually specifically advised. I'm an unusual case in that normally GLIO, you have 6 months to a year at best. And I've survived 6 years with this, which is extremely unusual. I'm very fortunate in that regard. And my oncologist and I talked about this, like, well, would it be good for me to go to support programs to maybe offer my story in that regard? And I was advised, maybe not, because there might be some resentment from families and other glio patients who haven't been as lucky as I am, who don't survive more than 6 months to a year, and that my presence might be upsetting in that regard, which is unfortunate, but it is what it is.
Yeah. Let's talk about resources for lodging, Amy. How does the burden of traveling affect cancer patients? It sounds like it can be pretty severe.
Yeah, it definitely can. The American Cancer Society does have Hope Lodges. There's over 30 Hope Lodges located all across the United States. If a cancer patient needs to travel in to a larger metro area for their cancer treatment, we do have Hope Lodges available where the cancer patient and at least one caregiver can stay free of charge for as long as they need to for their cancer care. We also have other lodging partners and other lodging assistants available in areas where there isn't a Hope Lodge. And even if there is a Hope Lodge, like the Hope Lodge in Rochester, Minnesota, it stays really busy. And so we do have other lodging partners that are available. So again, contacting the American Cancer Society to see what's available in your area. I would always, always, always recommend that when somebody's diagnosed with cancer to also take advantage of the social workers and patient navigators at your cancer centers. They really have a great pulse on what's happening locally. And so they may know of resources even that the American Cancer Society doesn't know about. So always talk to those within your cancer centers about what is available also.
It makes a lot of sense. How far do you have to travel for your own treatments?
Well, from day to day, not too far, thankfully. I live in central Illinois, and we've got a very good hospital in the immediate area. But I have had, there was at one point where I did need to travel to Chicago to meet with a world-recognized specialist with regards to my case. And I didn't know about the Hope Lodge program at the time. This was about a year or so ago. I hadn't been informed of that at that point. I wish I'd known then. But, yeah, I had to travel to and from Chicago for a treatment there. And thankfully, I don't need to do that going forward. I'm now able to get those particular treatments here in where I am now. But, yeah, it's It's a lot.
Yeah. Jane in Manitowoc has something. Hi, Jane.
Hello, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a retired County Veteran Service Officer, so I want to shout out to all the veterans out there about VA healthcare, especially like the Vietnam guys. There's 38 cancers on their list. The PAC Act just put out a dozen cancers, including glioblastoma for the guys that were over in the Middle East. That means free healthcare, free compensation every month of a couple thousand dollars while they're active cancer. And even if they're not active cancer, the most they're going to pay for medication is $11 a month. And things are $11 per medicine per month. So there's so much the VA does. And like my cancer guys here when I was CDSO, they were treated up at Green Bay at St. Vincent or down in Milwaukee at Frederick. So it doesn't even mean being inside the VA healthcare.
Jane, thank you so much for calling. Comment, Amy?
Yeah, the VA is absolutely wonderful. The American Cancer Society also has a website specifically for veterans. It's cancer.org/veterans that includes some additional resources specific to veterans because, as she mentioned, there's some really specific things that happen in the veterans community. And so we're happy to support the veterans also in any way that we can.
Yeah, for sure. You have, I think you may have mentioned it earlier, the American Cancer Society has a 24/7 helpline. When should people call that helpline or under what circumstances?
They can call anytime that they want to, anytime that they need to. They can call as many times as they want to. Really, the National Cancer Information Center is one of my favorite programs that the American Cancer Society has. Whether it's just someone needs to talk, someone needs somebody to listen. There's information about chemotherapy, radiation, immunotherapy. There's just cancer is so complex. It's not only the specific cancer type that you have that we have information on. There's also treatment options that you can talk to. We have oncology nurses on staff. So if you want to talk to someone as a medical professional, maybe someone outside of your doctor's office, you're always welcome to call. We have a health insurance team that can help with those that are uninsured or maybe underinsured. And we also have a connection with another organization that helps with insurance questions. Insurance is as confusing maybe as cancer is. So we have a lot of resources available. We do have Spanish-speaking specialists on staff. But we also work with a translation service. And so I think there's 265 different languages that we can help someone who calls in. So we're definitely here. And they, like I said before, there's a lot of resources that are available. And our cancer specialist at the Cancer Information Center can really dig into it. You had talked about the financial questions that people have. There are a lot of foundations and a lot of grants that are available. But some of them are really specific, whether it's specific to breast cancer or glioblastoma or children's cancer. And really the easiest way to get started on all of that is contacting the American Cancer Society. Let us help you. Yeah. That's what we're here for.
And one thing I'd like to add into that is one thing that these people are very good at is there's been times when I've called up the Cancer Society basically because I didn't know what questions to ask. I just didn't know what resources were potentially available, and I wasn't sure what kind of help I could ask for. And these people are willing and able and eager to answer those questions and to listen.
Yeah, and we're running out of time here, Isaac. What's the number, Amy? What's that hotline number again?
It is 1-800-227-2345.
227-2345. Amy,
yep.
Isaac, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you both so much for being with us today. Amy Kralichek is the Associate Director of the Access to Care Solutions Delivery Program of the American Cancer Society, and Isaac Scher, participant in the program. And thank you very much for listening.